Welcome back to Relevant Tones. I am Matthew Dosland. I'll be your host for this week. And today I am delighted to be joined by Frank Horvat, composer and all-around artist, activist, interesting human. I think your email sign-off is composer space human. How are you today, Frank? Thank you for being here as well.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm doing well, Matthew. It's great to join you.
I'm so excited to have you on because you have such a varied interest across, I think, to me at least, you know, musical subgenre in kind of our classical contemporary world that is so hard to pin genre down, and I usually avoid it. But you do have a varied sound, but a core ethos, a core identity that you're always talking about. And that is what I want to talk about first, which is your activism, your promotion of, you know, climate issues, your talk about, you know, what is going on in the world, and as well as mental health struggles and many different issues that I think everybody in the world faces today, and also musicians face, and musicians don't always talk about. Whether that's, there's a lot of reasons that people may not talk about something, but what is it about, let's say specifically some of your recent works around the climate? You took a trip to the Arctic and have composed some music based off of that, and what is it about climate activism that keeps you, you keep composing works around it?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I the question you're asking, I often wonder about myself, or a question at me, ask myself these questions: why do I do what I do, and that kind of thing. Yeah. And it is an interesting question, not to think of it in a sort of a too existential light, but it's sort of there's so many things that I'm interested in exploring through my music, and I think the core, the fabric of who I am as an individual is I sort of look at my creative musical practice as a form of, if I could say this, allowing me not to, trying to minimize the feeling of helplessness that I often feel about different things. You know, I was having a conversation with a really good friend of mine recently, and she was telling me how her partner was suffering incredibly because of the stuff that's going on in the world. Wars, especially in two major strategic parts of the world, and to see all the suffering that is happening. And I should preface what I'm saying by the fact that I know for a fact that culturally or ethnically, the people I'm referring to have absolutely no connection, direct connection to that part of the world. Yet, you know, because of our social media, you know, mass media, constant, you know, being thrown at all this constant content of the ills of the world, this my friend's partner is literally feeling depressed, and because of all this, and I guess it's just because the helplessness, the hopelessness of it all, and it got me thinking when I read her message to me about this. It got me thinking, maybe that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, is just not my way of solving things, because, you know, does art or does music really have the ability to go from war to peace? Does it have the ability to avert the climate crisis? Directly not, but maybe artists like me who do what we do, who we allow our work to reflect the world we live in, maybe we do it just as our own coping mechanism to deal with it. So it's an outlet to express ourselves or try to rationalize it or come to terms without it being through news bites and things like that. So that's one thing. And then in turn, if you get a chance to get it out there and people are interested in it, then maybe it provokes thought or provokes motivation for them and that type of thing. So when you earlier, you called me an activist, I sort of, sometimes I feel like not deserving of that title because of the fact that, you know, there's a lot of great activists out there that are, you know, doing things and they're campaigning and they're lobbying and they're organizing. And I don't feel like I really do a lot of that per se, unless it's somehow directly related to the, you know, the musical project I'm working on or my collaborators and I do it. So I often think of what I do or, you know, my colleagues who pursue these kind of issues through their work, you know, I think of us more as artivists, you know, and I love that term. I love that term artivist because it allows it, it gives us a special place in the world and an important place in the world. And, you know, I've had to work a lot on my own mental health to make me realize, and maybe you think this way too, or any, you know, practicing artist or musician is like, what am I doing? Like, you know, what difference am I making here, you know? And so I like this idea of the artivist thing because it makes me feel better that, and maybe helps other people better understand the unique place that us as artists have to contribute to trying to make the world a better place. So, I realized I didn't answer specifically about the climate, but I thought I'd just get that out there as far as a driving force behind, you know, the climate stuff that I'm interested in,
you really answered the issues. I think you answered the core of my question, which is like, it's answering, what am I doing as a musician? Right. I think is a question that many performers and composers struggle with. You know, you've been very open about your conversations about your mental health, and it's a really important discussion to have, especially I think in the current climate. Like you said, we do just get bombarded by world news in a way that, you know, 20 years ago you just couldn't be. Like you said, can our music directly affect it? Probably not. Indirectly, can it be a launching point for a conversation? Can it be a point that at least gets more people interested in the topic, more people into this conversation, more people thinking about things like what is happening to our Arctic, Antarctic health of the earth, if you will, and also our own mental health struggles within that, because it's hard to express something along those lines. It's hard to talk about something that is happening that is terrible and awful and try and be a mouthpiece for that. And I think for you as a composer, how do you, in your mental, kind of combining the two things, I mean, just mental health and being an artivist, if you will, you know, this, what is that balance like for you in trying to be a mouthpiece for some of these issues, but also staying grounded, staying healthy, and staying, I think, most importantly, positive and optimistic? Because I think it's very easy to walk down the other road of being negative and pessimistic about some of these things.
That's a great question. You know, like, I often think about this a lot, because, you know, even though all the various projects I work on are quite different in scope with different processes and different collaborators, and the outcome can be quite different, like, you know, the result of all the effort and the process can be quite different. You know, one of the things that sort of stays true with my own creative practice is the fact that I work really, really hard on my mindset not to think about what you were talking about the balance. So there the answer to your question is there is no balance, because when I conceive something and create and compose something, my number one priority, doesn't matter what the theme or the inspiration behind what I'm composing is, my number one priority is to value all the time, which is, does the work that I'm working on and composing reflect who I am? Am I being the true version of myself through this work? And I think this is where, you know, I have a lot of respect for musicians, and I have a lot of friends who work in the pop music world, you know, and churning out songs and, you know, and wanting to get, you know, placements and film and television with their songs and, you know, and get, you know, popular singers to try to get them and to get in there. And I have a lot of respect for the artistic practice of that, because I stylistically, I tend to bounce around a lot. So I do have a lot, but the fundamental difference, I remember when I was in university, when they were talking about different types of musicians, you know, they divided musicians basically, like there's art musicians, there's popular musicians and folk musicians. And I think for the art musician is like an artist, you know, somebody, I like, that's why I love the art world so much. And I learned so much for it, not just in the content, and I get inspiration from the content, but also the idea of somebody gives you a commission to compose or to paint, pardon me, you know, a painting or whatever. And the expectation is that that artist can do whatever they want to reflect who they are. Mm-hmm. So once it's created, then I usually take that hat off and then put on the hat of, okay, now how do we get this out there? Mm. And in essence, that's actually the most fundamental difference between being an artist and an entrepreneur, right? I've had a lot of people who I love in my life who are very strong people in my life, family members and loved ones who love what I do and are supportive of what I do, but you know, they naively ask, well, why don't you just compose music that, you know, people will want to listen to, you know? And when you hear something like that, I don't disparage them, because yes, it is my career and I'm very fortunate to make a good chunk of my living from composing music, but I couldn't do that obviously because of the type of musician I want to be, which is that, you know, I want to have complete creative control so it reflects exactly who I am. And then I will deal later with, well, how the heck should we get this out there? Like, what's the best way to get it out there? And that, of course, is not good entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship is all about, well, you look at the market, you see what product or service is lacking, and then you go about to try to fill the void. Well, I don't think that way. I don't listen to every episode of Relevant Tones and say, okay, well, what are composers not doing and what can I do to plug it in so I can stand out, you know? So it, of course, that means it becomes a little bit of a hit and miss, right? Sometimes people are really super interested in something, one piece I composed, and in the other piece that I worked so hard on that I love so much and that I put my heart into the soul, you know, hardly anybody, you know, listens to it, or, you know, that kind of thing. And I've accepted that. At first, when I was a young composer, I had a really hard time with that. And, you know, because you're working so hard and you want the validation from others. But I think the number one thing for any creative person is, would you be doing this if nobody was ever interested in talking to you about what you do? And if the answer is yes, then, you know, the type of conversation we're having today, as much as I'm enjoying this and I love this, it's not my main motivation of why I am a composer. I'm a composer because I can't help but do this, and this is the only thing I can do. So that is an unbalanced approach. But in this case, usually we think of balance as being a healthy thing. I think in this case, as an artist, it's the most healthy thing to have that lopsided type of way. And, you know, I'll admit sometimes, you know, from a career standpoint, that can get frustrating and hard, because then you're trying to figure out, well, I created this zany thing, you know, with a zany concept of how it should be performed. And, you know, and it's it's so logistically impossible or whatever, you know, and just makes people scratch their heads that they can't do it. Well, I have to live with that, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's okay. That's okay to be like,
yeah,
that, so.
That's a really interesting thing. Like the balance isn't the way, yeah, that's the unbalancing of it is what is the commitment and the drive, if you will, for that. It's very interesting. And you mentioned a little bit like inspiration and kind of how you know, arrive at a piece and think about it and conceptualize it. You've had a few premieres recently. I Am Ice with the Annex Singers, inspired by your Arctic Expedition. And also, I should say, Leonore Anthony's poems. What about being in the Arctic and being more disconnected from, you know, society, culture, ongoing things around the world, but being so connected and in such immediacy with nature? What was that juxtaposition like? And then how did that lead into that inspiration for that piece?
Well, I mean, that whole experience was probably the most extremely privileged thing that's ever happened in my life, you know, to be invited, you know, on a tall ship that, you know, sails around the Arctic the Svalbard archipelago north of Norway, with 29 other artists of various disciplines from around the world, plus some guides. So 40 of us on a ship for, you know, 3 weeks. It was an absolutely amazing thing that will stay with me until the day I die, you know. And as we're recording this, it was over a little over 6 months ago when that journey and that residency ended. And I was telling one of my shipmates on that the other day. It's like how it feels like it just happened yesterday. Like I just got off the ship yesterday. It's still so vivid in my heart and my memory. I think, and the reason why I earlier said that it was a privilege to be on this, because, you know, as somebody who's sensitive to climate issues and ensuring that my own artistic practice leaves as little carbon footprint, you know, as possible, and also my everyday life, you know, I acknowledge the fact that, you know, going halfway across the world and taking planes and that kind of thing is, you know, it can be feel a little bit hypocritical, even though I did all my carbon offsetting and so forth. And, you know, for my fellow artists who were on the ship, while we were on the ship, having a lot of deep conversations about experiencing all of the amount of vastness and glacier and open ocean and wildlife and barrenness that was around us. It was something that we often talked about, you know, do we have a right to be here? And if done in as sustainable a fashion as possible, which I feel very strongly that effort the part of the organizers did achieve that based on the size of our ship and the smallness of our group and the impact we made on the surroundings we were there, including, you know, picking up garbage while we were there and doing a lot of, you know, outreach things and that kind of thing. Despite that, it comes back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, I think it's so important for us as artists to have those experiences, especially because of the important place that we lead in this world, right? We have the ability to create things or get inspired by things, create things because of that inspiration, and then put it out to the world. And while I was on the trip, I had a million ideas of compositions that I would like to, you know, to bring about. And just in a short time frame since that trip, like you mentioned, I've already was able to compose and get a new choral work premiered that sort of grasped that time. And just talking to the singers who were in the choir and talking about how the music made them feel, it was so amazing because of the fact that they, none of them had been on the trip that I was on, but they were so, they almost felt like they were. And that was really sort of gratifying for me to know that the music was able to convey that, and the text that was written by, like you said, Leonora Anthony, who is an artist and a poet based in Miami. And she wasn't on the same expedition I was, but she had gone the year earlier. So for us to collaborate on something like that, to convey those emotions, those feelings, to bring about, the result being maybe to bring about more awareness or appreciation for the fragility and the vulnerability of this absolutely beautiful part of the world, I felt almost like a little bit like an ambassador or a special representative, I took the whole experience very seriously. And even though, like I said earlier, I compose for myself and it's a reflection of me, I also feel like a little bit of a sense of responsibility now, that I had this very privileged opportunity to go out there and see this amazing stuff, that is amazing.
Yeah, it's obviously a unique experience, and that traveling in kind of the climate part that you talk about in the carbon offsetting. You are based in Canada. You're a Canadian composer. Canada is a pretty unique country in kind of the sense of its vastness. Very few countries are as large. A large place, it's not terribly inhabited outside of about 100 miles from the U.S.-Canadian border. There's a great sense of vastness. There's an Arctic tundra in Canada that's very crucial to the world, the Earth's health. Did you find any different relationships? And I know after you got off the ship in Svalbard, you also spent some time in Norway, Sweden, Estonia, Finland, and the Netherlands. Did you find any? I'm just curious about the differences between the way those cultures also interact with their kind of vast north spaces, their kind of climate impact, as well as Canadian climate impact, which you've spoken about and written pieces around, the issues of fracking, the issues of taking things from the earth and to, power yeah. non-renewable things. What, and Norway has a very large, very important oil industry, while being a country very committed to climate issues and a country that its people like to think a lot about nature and their relationship with nature, at least. That's a specific example, but I mean, what did you find any cultural differences there? Like, was there a, what was that like?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities, actually, like sort of the geopolitical situation, and just the state of the economy. Canada is known as quite a progressive liberal democracy. And so that exists also in Scandinavia with a lot of, things that perhaps my friends in the U.S. don't have, like universal health care, a really strong social safety net, so there's a lot of similarities in that respect. There's also an important, like you said, an important cultural connection to the vastness as far as the heritage of the country goes, and the different countries of the North go. So that is really important. But all the unfortunate similarities are the sort of the corporate forces that are engaged in these countries that are making the population feel like the only way for a country to move forward is through the extraction of valuable, you know, natural resources that are hugely money making. And so I find it a bit of a paradox, to be quite honest. And I'm not doing this as a means to disparage my friends in Scandinavia. If anything, I'm just trying to say that it's exactly the same idea here in Canada. We celebrate the nature, we celebrate the vastness, but we continue to produce one of the countries that produces the most oil in our oil and gas sector. Despite numerous calls for what's happening in the world these days, is actually doing more than they've ever done before. So, you know, so how are we part of the problem and the solution? And I think this is where sometimes the optics of things come in, you know. And this is a really strong issue, because then it gets into divisive politics about, well, you know, you're progressive and you promote equal rights and you promote reconciliation with, you know, Aboriginal peoples, yet you are building pipelines. And those same indigenous peoples are telling you not to do it, please, through our land and so forth. But when it comes to the almighty dollar, oh no, we have to do it. We have no other choice. And so I want to preface everything by saying that despite everything I just said, I am proud to be Canadian. I love where I live. I can't think of any other country I'd rather live in the world, but that doesn't mean that there has to be a lot of work still done to enact, you know, a positive force moving forward. And I know you mentioned earlier about mental health, and this is where sometimes sometimes my work, the different issues that I like my music to reflect, I find that sometimes they overlap each other. So, you know, one of my personal feelings right now is that our world is struggling, other than climate, is struggling with a whole bunch of issues around, you know, social justice issues, human rights, war, cost of living, inflation. I feel like there's so much we need to solve, and those things often can be rooted in mental health issues. And I think that the climate as well is like that. And I think that our relationship with nature, our appreciation for it, and the means in which we feel like we have to take to protect it can be severely distracted by society at large, just because, you know, when you are dealing with an addiction, when you're dealing with perhaps an abusive loved one, how can you, you know, or you have to decide on a given month, am I going to be paying rent this month, or am I going to be, buying groceries? I can't do both. So, you know, when you're dealing with those kind of issues in your everyday life, plus unresolved issues from your past, and you don't have any help to get that, how can we expect people to say, well, we got to protect the Arctic up there, you know, or, you know, it's really crazy, you know. Even though I'm so passionate about our, you know, the natural world, in essence, the natural world really doesn't care about us. You know, it's going to keep going on without us. We can be wiped out as a species on this planet, and somehow this planet will care. So what I guess I'm really saying is, what I care in essence about is humans' relationship with the natural world, right? You know, I think these are all the times, the types of things I'm thinking about, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I that's a very, very good point to make, is that when there are, and there always are, multiple issues and multiple things going on, especially when it pertains to one's own mental health. Prioritizing yourself, especially in the kind of scenario you laid out, is incredibly important. And realizing that you can do what you can, but you know, if British Petroleum and Exxon don't change their ways, you know, that's, you know, I can be as carbon neutral as I want, but my impact is certainly less than certain companies or certain industries. Also to say, I live in the US, I'm a US citizen, not throwing stones at glass houses. Mm-hmm. We also have many of these same issues. And, you know, it's not unique to the oil industry, Scandinavia traditionally, timber, very timber heavy industries, fishing in Norway as well. You know, there are ways to do those sustainably, of course, but
I'm happy you're bringing this up because this is something you mentioned, the fracking musical project I did recently. This was a song cycle about fracking. We called it Fractures, and I set the text of 12 different poets for these 13 songs. And, you know, the one thing that we went into that process of creating that is precisely what you're talking about. And this is the other important thing about our world moving forward. What that working on that project taught me, you know, before I started that project, I knew about the negative and the detrimental impact of fracking on our planet, on societies and culture. But the one thing that I learned so importantly through the text and the work of the poets that I was setting is the impact that the mindset that many people who work in the oil and gas industry who feel I have no other choice. And it's not the, we're exploring that you have no other choice. You actually start to think like them and believe like they have no other choice. And I think that this is the other thing that I feel like we have to do, especially in our divisive world. And I've been hearing more and more people talking about this. The great New York Times columnist, David Brooks, he recently came out with a great book about, you know, conversation and understanding people. I've heard the interviews. I haven't read the book yet, but I've been hearing him do interviews about it. And it's just about how do we understand how other people are thinking and working? And not just that, but have perhaps empathy for them. Where do we have similarities? I know the Dalai Lama teaches that. I did a project a bunch of years ago, which was talking about unifying the world and how can people of different mindsets and, you know, who technically should be maybe enemies or that kind of thing, how can they better understand each other? And I found his work on this topic really profound as well. And I think music and art is a really, really great way to do that. Even myself working on this project about fracking, I thought I was going to be composing music that was going to be like, oh, fracking is bad and fracking is evil and that kind of thing. And, you know, and even though there are certain songs in the song cycle that refer to that, you know, and bring that up as a point, I ended up being so surprised by how much like sympathy I had for, you know, the gentleman roughneck working in North Dakota, sitting at a bar, you know, drinking a beer and wallowing away in the ruggedness of his life and thinking, you know, why can't we have sympathy for that kind of person and understanding of why they do that? And then maybe use that as a basis to give us a more worldly view than our sort of our narrow view. So for me, it's that, you know, liberal activist, you know, that kind of thing. But there's a lot of people out there that, you know, don't think that way because of the reasons why we said earlier. So,
yeah, I think mentioning empathy and that pursuit of empathy and understanding and being sympathetic, especially to the individual, to the working person who lives in Minot, North Dakota, and wants to have food and a roof over their head. And guess what the industry in Minot is? People are going to do these jobs and you do have to have empathy for the person in that situation, and you do have to understand that fracking bad is not the entire story. The company that does the fracking and those kinds of things, you can say that's a, they are doing this purely to make money, having no consideration for the earth, having no consideration for the future of, you know, people or life on the earth. But you do have to, that point about empathy is very, very, very important, I think. And I'm glad you brought that up. I should also mention the Fractures album. I just want to make sure those who might not know, fantastic album. Meredith Hall is the soprano on it, and Bram Goldhammer is the pianist. Beautiful album. Please give it a listen. The first track is very gripping, sets the tone, and it's a very, very good good experience if you let it be, I think. And it's very empathetic. I think it does. There are beautiful moments in that album. Beautiful sounds created by machines of destruction is an interesting thing.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate your feedback on it. It really means a lot to me that you think of it that way. It was a project that we poured a lot of heart and soul. Meredith and I worked on it for years, and what I really appreciate about that project is, you know, just getting back to our arts and culture community, and you know, and the idea of collaboration, is that it truly was a collaboration. As I said, we worked with and curated poems from 12 different poets who live in different, mostly in the US actually, where of course fracking is a huge industry where in your country where you live. And so to have, you know, poets and hear their stories behind their work and why they compose this, it's just such an eye opener to, you know, to something that I knew very little about. So I think that's one of I feel blessed to have the life that I have, because often I learn so much from working on projects and I learn so much from others. I think that's such a huge thing, and because you learn and you get inspired by the work of others and the talented people that you work with, you can really, I sort of feel like I open up my musical voice in directions that I didn't think I could go, but at the same time, I learn so much, you know, on these issues that our projects are reflecting.
Award with all, including the tongue-tied board members. members who sat at the table of the largest mining disaster in recent history. And for you, the audience so adorned, let me thank fur-bearing animals for dying, the canaries too, as our oxygen thins worldwide.
It's really interesting to talk about how that all interacts and how that eventually turns into a piece of music. And I want to talk about something also that you mentioned about kind of the zany how things come together, you know, how you get something and then you're trying to find someone to actually put on a piece of music. You premiered a very unique art piece, art installation. I'm not sure. I couldn't quite pin down how to describe it. In November, you premiered All That Remains, Residual Moments. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition of, you know, recorded, you know, film. You know, it's recording, talking, you know, it's combined of editing a recorded film into a triptych and then putting live musicians that were the people who were recorded in the same space while showing that and layering it. And how did that idea come about, that type of installation? I love art installations. I must agree with you about, you know, art and artists, you know, painters and sculptors are so interesting, and art installations in museums are so cool when they have multimedia. Yeah. And I love that. And I'm very grateful to be living in the area that I am, because I have the Walker Art Museum. I have Minneapolis Institute of Art. I have these amazing contemporary art institutes. So one, how did that come about? But then two, what was it like actually putting that together and putting live musicians with themselves behind them? You know, what was that like?
It was awesome. It was so great. I loved working on that project so much. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, other than music, probably I love all other artistic disciplines, and I love collaborating with, you know, people outside of my immediate musical sphere. But without a doubt, just on a personal level, I think I'm most intrigued often by visual art. I'm like, I feel like sometimes I'm addicted to various YouTube channels, just watching, you know, artist talks, you know, like Art 21 is a fantastic one, you know, just talking about artists' process and seeing them work and create, and then they show the outcome. And I'm just like, for me, that's just like, oh my gosh, it's so awesome. Yeah. So, you know, this has been going on for years, just my infatuation with, you know, visual artists and the work they do and their process. And I've always tried to figure out some similarities in that. And so I've always been passionate about that. And so from a very sort of artistically selfish standpoint, I'm like, how can I weasel my way into that world a bit, you know, because I can't draw or paint or anything like that. I definitely can't do that, or I don't feel comfortable doing that. So like, how can I just use my musical to, you know, talent to get myself in there? Exactly. So I think that's, to answer the first part of your question, that's number one motivation. The second motivation, though, was that feeling of collaboration. And finally, third, creating something that would reflect sort of like a project that would give voice to people that often don't feel like they have a voice. And that is specifically classically trained instrumentalists. You know, not to say that vocalists don't deal with things, but I think there is sort of more of a culture within the vocal world that, you know, you're singing words, it's related to the ultimate form of human expression, you know, to share that. But I find that, you know, sometimes we almost treat like instrumentalists as just blind, that you're up there, you play, you don't really know what's going on in their head. I mean, you can relate to this. You're a cellist, right?
You know, what I always describe it as, and I think the point you're getting at here, if I may, is I always call us, we are the most highly trained jukebox you've ever
correct
met. That is absolutely what we are. A classically trained instrumentalist is designed to play a thing the way it's, and I'm doing air quotes for this is an audio format, you know, the way it's supposed to be played. Exactly. And there isn't an idea of the actual performers, unless you're one of the handful of soloists that get to make a career have an amazing career, and nothing against them, but they have a little more artistic fulfillment in that sense, at least, that they can have their own voice. If you're in an orchestra, it is not really your voice. But you are you are very technically on it and perfect. And I'm glad to hear you talk about that. And I'll let you speak more on it now. But the idea of trying to pull the voice out of a classically trained instrumentalist is not always easy and not always a quick process. But please.
No, I agree with you. And I think it has to do with, you know, the tradition that many of us have followed, yes. You know, that they're the sort of, like, I call it the old way of teaching, which is you sit down, you shut up, and you practice, and you do what your teacher tells you to do. And then you go out there and you try to do a lot of replication performances of things that came before, right? And so that whole culture of the way your upbringing is and the strict discipline of that isn't exactly allowing us as an audience to appreciate or ask or hear from you. Like, well, what's in your heart? What are you feeling? What are your hopes, dreams, and fears, you know? And so I think that was sort of the big motivation behind the Residual Moments project, was how can we create a project, a musical project, that would allow us to hear from various instrumentalists talking about their past. Because, you know, as the old adage goes, you can't really move forward in life or really understand a person in the present unless you know where they've come from. So this, again, this idea of empathy and sort of understanding, well, when I see you perform, maybe I'm hearing you perform the way you do, or you have certain mannerisms or that kind of thing, because you had such an certain experience in your life. So it was a really multi-step, multi-process project that I was very fortunate to work on with a talented experimental film artist based here in Toronto, Danila Josephson, and we partnered on this for literally years. We started working on this in 2018. It took over 5 years to get this off the ground. And it was just from the planning. Then what we did was we video recorded interviews with all the musicians. And then what I asked after the musicians did their interview, where they were asked about various questions about their past, or stories they wanted to share about their past, and sort of cataloging that and archiving all of that, I also asked them to improvise on their instrument. Because like you said earlier, a lot of instrumentalists don't get a chance, especially classically trained, to actually improvise. And I think that's an incredible pity. But I wanted them to improvise right after they talked about whatever they talked about, so it would be sort of really firmly connected with what was in their hearts. So that was all video recorded. Ganilla incorporated it into the triptych film. And then once she was done her work, I composed, in essence, I became a film composer at this point. I composed a score which incorporated the five different instruments represented by the 11 different musicians in the group. And I incorporated a fixed electronics part. And then we did what we call a performance art installation. So like you, the other great thing about this project is to think about, and this is something really passionate about, and again, it has to do with going against the constructs of what, you know, constitutes a performance of classical art music, is how do we take this out of the traditional concert hall and put it in a place that you normally wouldn't hear music, which is an art gallery, right? Mm-hmm. We normally do not hear live music in an art gallery unless it is structured as a concert. Yes. But how do you construct a work where the audience, they're not audiences, they're attendees to a performance art installation. In other words, they can walk in and out, they can roam about and stand anywhere they wish, as long as they don't touch the musicians or distract the musicians playing live. And they can come and go whenever they please. They can walk in and perceive it from different angles. And so it became this really great experiment about how also music can connect with people and how we don't have to always work within the construct, the traditional construct of come into a room, sit down, be quiet, it starts, no clapping until it's over, get up and leave. And we'll tell you when you're allowed to clap, we'll tell you when you're allowed to leave. I love this idea that we don't have to have these rigid rules, you know, and let let the audience feel their way through the whole work. If you want to walk around, walk around. If you want to sit down in one spot and watch, watch. If you want to lie down, for the triptych, the three different things, you know, I love all this, you know, and it was a really successful project in sort of thinking outside the box about how we can hear from musicians that we normally don't hear from and how people can absorb stuff in a more interesting way.
Yeah, the prescriptive nature of the typical classical music experience is definitely something I've seen a lot of pushback on from even the performers that I know who are, you know, on that track and going for that orchestral position. You know, that's one job to pursue, and they want that. And that's what they want. Even those people are really pushing back on this prescriptive idea of the classical music experience, which you laid out very nicely right there. It's come in, sit down, shut up, listen, and you'll get out. You'll get out eventually. Which yeah, isn't always the best.
I'm laughing, but you're telling the truth there.
Laughing because it hurts. That's okay. Yeah,
because it's the truth. Best comedy is the truth.
Yes. But it's so interesting when people take that experience somewhere new, like you did. And I should say the Thin Edge New Music Collective is the group that is the group of musicians that you were working with on that piece. And you talked a little bit about this, and I want to dig deeper into this.
Sure.
You, just the length of your compositions, if we might talk about just something really oddly specific.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I think my favorite example of it is there's kind of two things. One, you've talked a little bit about expanding the length of this installation to, I think, 12 hours. You wrote somewhere on your website, something like that. I love that. I love, I'm a big fan personally of just long form things because they're really interesting to experience something over hours. It's this really weird thing. But also, you do have a tendency to write things between 2 and 5 minutes. I see a lot. You have these really short things, and then also I'm gonna add one more thing here. What's the name of the Music for Self-Isolation? That's it.
Right.
That is a little over 2 hours of 2 minute pieces. It's a really weird juxtaposition, I think. So why is that? Why what's going on with that juxtaposition of like this long form but short form?
That's a really good question. I'm thinking that There's different answers for the different lengths. First of all, the Music for Self-Isolation project was a project that I did during the pandemic, where I just on a whim just wrote really super short solo pieces for my friends who were stuck at home that didn't have anything to play, something new for them to play that reflected the time that all of us were living through of being in isolation. So, you know, for it to be a bit of a community engagement project and nothing too stressful, I purposely made the pieces short because I wanted to challenge myself and write short pieces. But I thought that there's a lot of times a great creative challenge in being able to say something something in a short package. I generally don't write a lot of short pieces. If I do, they'll often appear in a larger suite, like a song cycle or a suite and things. And I love that kind of thing, because then, you know, they can be miniatures, but there's also a bigger story being told by the entire suite. But otherwise, I do tend to these days be really enamored with the longer form pieces. And for some reason, I keep coming back to an hour exactly. And I think I have a little bit of an OCD complex. There's something about the challenge of you're going to listen to a piece that's exactly 60 minutes, like, you know, not, you know, give or take a few seconds. In fact, I've composed some solo piano pieces that are played with a click track. I became so infatuated being exactly 60 minutes to a second that it is to the second, because it's done to a click and while it's performed. And, you know, and this might be coming from the same part of my heart and soul that, you know, wants all the dishes to be piled into the dishwasher exactly the same way. You know, maybe I'm sharing too much stuff about my personal self, but yeah, I tend to have these tendencies, and I guess I can't help but sometimes apply it to that. But more important than that, I feel the reason why I'm really sort of infatuated with these longer form experiences is that I really feel strongly that a composition should be as an immersive experience as possible. First and foremost for me, you know, while I'm writing it and to absorb it. And I'm sort of like, I always say that's the litmus test. If it's doing it for me, then it's worthy to put out to the world and give other people a chance to absorb it. And there's something about that sort of immersive thing I've been getting a lot into in the last about 5-10 years into meditation. That's become a really big part of my process. And, you know, a lot of those longer form compositions, when they're performed, I'm actually quite surprised to hear from audiences that talk about their perception of time. You know, their idea that, well, that didn't really feel like that long, or that was an hour, really, blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's really about what you're having to say in those long form. I think it's a lot easier for me personally, my musical language, to say a lot of things without getting too busy and trying to shovel a ton of ideas in there, but trying to make it instead of an immersive experience. But it still gives you that wiggle room.
please.
I was just going to say, especially in our arts and culture community, if our goal in, you know, in our artistic practice, if our end goal is to engage as many people as possible with the work mm-hmm. that we, you know, that we compose or perform, then why would we be any facet of that sector be against more diversity? Because we live in a very diverse world, and we want, you know, people to be inspired of all walks of life, to be inspired and bring as many people to the thing. I think there's always this argument about relevance, right? Relevance mm-hmm. from our bad self-esteem as individual artists, but especially in the classical art music world, you know, the contemporary music world, there is a lot of this relevance that we're sort of on the fringe and that kind of thing. Well, how do you become more mainstream is to ensure that there's as many voices at the table representing the diverse world we live in, you know what I mean? Yes. So I think we have to be really careful as artists. It's easy to get into sort of a mindset, a scarcity mindset.
Yes.
That though there's only so much opportunities, there's only so much money. Listen, if you're really passionate about something and you want something to happen and you're doing it from the goodness of your heart, then it will happen. I wholeheartedly believe that. And it doesn't matter if you are, you know, anybody, you know, man, woman, how you recognize gender wise or sexual orientation, it's all possible. And I think that that's especially important for people who normally came from marginalized communities who didn't get that opportunity to realize. And those who are sort of old fashioned or narrow minded thinking, well, now all of a sudden we're no more experience, no more chances. Well, listen, I'm sitting here, I'm a white man, and I'm still getting opportunities that keep me busy, and I don't feel stifled. I don't feel cheated. So anybody out there who's thinking, oh, well, this is too much, you know, politically correctness or woke this or blah, you know, mm-hmm. BS like that. Well, guess what, folks? You're living with a scarcity mindset because you think that there's finite. We live in a world of abundance. No matter how much you think the world is tainted or has problems, we can probably all acknowledge that, serious problems we have to overcome, but the one thing we don't have a problem with is abundance. Mm-hmm. we live in a world of abundance, so that's why I think it's healthy, because it goes in line with the energy of our world that anything is possible. A human being wants something to happen, it can happen. So we have to invite more people into that mindset, so because we'll all be more healthy because of it. So for me, again, what do we keep coming back to, Matthew? Mental health, right? It's a yes. mindset. Every issue, mm-hmm. everything we're talking about always comes down to our mindset and where our heart and soul are set. So
absolutely. And I think that's you put it very beautifully, and I agree wholeheartedly with everything you've just said. It's absolutely true. And I think that's probably as good a place as any to finish our chat. And again, thank you so much for coming on, for being a part of this. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. And for anybody listening, frankhorvat.com, there's plenty of things. You can see discography, you can see projects, you can find things. There are albums available on Bandcamp, you can buy them. Various record labels, go out, find them, listen to his music. It's a joy to listen to, and it's been a joy talking with you.
Thanks so much, Matthew. It's been a thrill. I'm a big fan of Relevant Tones, so to be a guest on this is pretty awesome. So thanks for having me.
That means a lot. Thank you so much. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit with the mission to provide equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. If you would like to support Relevant Tones, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/relevanttones. For $5 a month, you can support this great podcast that brings creative music to you every week. For Relevant Tones, I'm Matthew Dosland. Thank you so much for listening.